This morning in our liturgy service, we read two pieces by the Zen teacher Hakuen Eikaku, who lived in the 17th century in Japan and was part of the Rinzai school of Zen. And the first piece, the Song of Zazen, is one of the very first pieces that I ever encountered when I was first exposed to the Zen virus. I got really sick, and now my body's full of antibodies, I guess. I don't know. I think that metaphor just sank into the muck from which it came. Anyway, I love this piece. I think it was important to my first teacher, who had been trained at the Rochester Zen Center. I imagine that's why we recited it in our Living Dharma Center, which is the first place that I learned about Zen, formally, that is, Zazen, sitting practice. And also, I came across it in a book by Robert Aitken Roshi, who, unbeknownst to me, would become my Dharma grandfather when I encountered James Ford 20 years after I began with my first teacher and took vows with James. And, of course, some of you know the story, that then he gave me transmission, and here we are. So from these two similar sources, which find their root in some Japanese teachers who brought a particular way of doing koan practice to the United States, Yasutani Roshi, Yamada Roshi, and going back even one more generation, Harada Roshi. And these folks found a way to take their Soto training, deeply rooted in Shikantaza, this practice of just sitting and opening to whatever arises, without trying to meddle with it, as I've once heard somebody say as a definition of Shikantaza. This not meddling is very important. But of course, in the way we understand things, even meddling is part of Shikantaza. So no escape. Everything we're doing is Shikantaza. Everything we're doing is just sitting, opening to the presence of everything that arises as the awakened heart, even though sometimes it has a very good disguise. Sometimes it seems like this couldn't be it, and there's a long category all of us have of what couldn't be it. Meddling being one of these things. And we also carry around certain ideas of what enlightenment is. And some of this comes from pop culture, which I think the idea of this finds its roots in some of the early introduction of Zen to this country through the amazing, wonderful, scholarly, and quite alive writings of D.T. Suzuki, a teacher, who wrote many books in English and an English translation about Rinzai Zen and enlightenment. Unfortunately, the way that most of us who have certain kinds of minds work, and I would say this is true of most educated Americans anyway, we like to attach ourselves to certain ideas about what awakening is, and then we hold onto those ideas for dear life. And those ideas, of course, get in the way of recognizing that we're already awake, and that awakening is not a change in quality of being. It's a change in recognition. It's a realization, a waking up to something that's been here for the whole time. And Hakuen, who was a 17th century teacher in Japan in the Rinzai school, of course, worked very hard with his students on helping them to find this for themselves. And sometimes we have an image of him because he was quite a strong and sometimes, I'm trying to avoid using the word violent, but I guess he could get violent in his language and his, maybe some of his actions. He was so determined to help people to see this thing that was right in front of their eyes that they were missing because of their ideas about it. And so he would wield his wisdom sword and cut through that particular delusion again and again and again. And he did this, and this is true of many teachers, based on his own experiences. He was a person who really couldn't believe that he was already awake, a very typical thing for most of us. And he worked really, really hard and drove himself to the wall to come to awakening. And he had, according to his autobiographies, he wrote about himself a bit, many, many, many experiences of waking up, and every one was different from the one before, and every one was a different size from the one before. He had big awakenings and little awakenings, and he used to like to call the little awakenings the kinds of experiences that make you laugh. So from that, those little tip of the tongue tastes, we sometimes say, of awakening, all the way to something enormous. Somehow or other, popular culture hooked onto the something enormous. And we now, modern 21st century Americans, no matter what our teachers tell us, don't believe it, and instead believe that someday we will have that huge explosive experience and we'll be just like Hakuin was in the 17th century. But Hakuin himself, in these two writings, the first one that I mentioned, the Song of Zazen, and then this new one, new to our new edition, liturgy book, Great Doubt, is very clear about it already being here. Even though he's been misinterpreted over and over and over again, his clarity about the fact that he knew for himself, and he says it in this new piece, knowing for yourself by drinking it, whether water is warm or cold. This was his experience of awakening. Because after the dog and pony show settles down, there's just this, stretching for miles, filling the universe, unavoidable. And he says in Song of Zazen that we're already standing in the middle of it. He says, this very place is the lotus land, this very body, the Buddha, this very thing we're experiencing it, that we're experiencing, this is what we long for. This is it. This is what it looks like. This is what it smells like and feels like. And we will make our categories and reject many things that don't seem to fit into our poor little brain's idea of what awakening is. But ultimately, we have to get tired of doing that. Sesshin is a wonderful way to get tired of doing that, because we're literally tired. Those of us sleeping over are not sleeping in our own beds. Maybe we're not getting the kind of sleep we're accustomed to. Strange things happen in the night. Well, most of those strange things happen in our very own minds. And on and on and on we go. And we have to sit still for long periods of time and not talk to other people and not make eye contact. Very tiring. And then, of course, what we get tired of finally is the way our minds are continually producing theories and thoughts about life. And this production business, this construction business, as my first teacher used to call it, this constructing reality, when reality is right here, one of the greatest delusions and yet also one of the most human. When we finally get tired of all the work we're doing inside to shield ourselves from the reality of the awakened heart, then the awakened heart, which has just been waiting around, manifesting as light on the floorboards, manifesting as the person next to you sniffling, manifesting as the heat coming on in the radiator, the traffic noise, everything without exception, it's been waiting for you to see it. Not that it's a person or a being or has a personality itself. It is in everything. So all it knows is to exist. And in that existing, it gets recognized continually offering itself to us, but we don't see it. How strange. How normal. And that's why when we do have a little experience, whether it's a tip of the tongue or the whole nine yards or whatever, it's almost unbelievable. And that opening quickly sinks back down under the level of consciousness because it just doesn't fit with this endless narrative that we tell about ourselves and about how the world is. Our hearts open and then, boom, back we go to the old stories, the old songs that we insist on singing even though the world itself is made of music and light and the world itself is everything that we've ever wanted. Hakuin says in Song of Zazen, all beings by nature are Buddha. That is, all beings by nature are already awakened beings. Just the way ice by nature is water. And that's important because we are Buddhas, but because we don't know it, we fail to recognize it. In his piece, Great Doubt, which is the new one, I'm just going to read it through and comment a little bit on a few things in it. He talks about one of the, what Philip Kaplow called the three pillars of Zen, in his famous book with that title. Great Doubt is one of the three pillars of Zen, Great Faith, and Great Determination. And this is certainly how I learned this from my first teacher and all the other teachers and James Ford and everybody who I ever read about Zen from or learned about Zen from. But recently, James Ford turned me on to a new book that is actually an old book. It was published a number of years ago by Jeffrey Broughton, who's a translator who, interestingly, lives in Long Beach, California, which is where James and his wife Jan have moved to. But they don't know each other, and James suspects he's retired. He was a university professor. But Jeffrey Broughton translated our Linji Lu, which we used as a text, maybe it was last year, the collected sayings and doings of Linji, who was, that's Rinzai's Chinese name. And he has quite an interesting way of translating things by going back to the original Chinese, trying to understand what a Zen practitioner or a Chan practitioner would have meant when he or she said these things, and then bringing them into modern English in a surprising way. So I just wanted to share with you, before I talk about Great Doubt, a few things about the three pillars of Zen as translated by Jeffrey Broughton from a teacher who originated them named Gao Feng, who lived in the 13th century in China. And Gao Feng called them the three essentials. And instead of great faith, which for us modern-day 21st century Americans, especially those of us raised in the Christian tradition, can be a problematic word, he called it the faculty of great confidence. A kind of a certainty, a knowing that this is what I must be doing. We've been talking about this in some of our Dharma dialogues already. This sense of what else could I be doing? Even though we make up a reason for why we're doing it that ultimately gets seen through and most often gets replaced by a new reason, and then that gets seen through and then that goes on and on and on until there's just nothing we can do. And this great confidence, this great sense of being able to perceive, because Broughton calls it a faculty of great confidence, knowing that when we hear the words of masters of the past, of our current teachers, there are moments when we're so touched and moved that we just know. It's not an intellectual knowing. It's not a figuring out kind of knowing. It's and it's not even certainty, because, of course, as we know, that would be delusive. But it's confidence. And then he calls determination, and I love this, the determination of great fury. Not just, got to do it, got to get up and make the donuts, got to do this thing, got to come to Zazen, but, ugh! So, confidence and fury combined with each other are a powerful mix. It's like a fire is lit underneath us. We must know what it means to be human. And some of us orient towards what it means to be us. Who am I? And others of us orient more towards trying to figure out what this reality that we've been born into is all about, and what is it is where we go. So the great two koans, who am I and what is it? You might say that all the koans ultimately fall into these two categories. Who is this self and what is going on? And this generates a great fury in Broughton's translation. And then great doubt itself. So Broughton's translation is sensation of great indecision and apprehension. So this is not an intellectual doubt, like, I don't get it, this doesn't make any sense to me, this is stupid. It's a much more profound doubt. It's a feeling of not knowing where the ground is under our feet anymore. It's a feeling of not being able to turn one way or the other, not being able to understand what's the best thing to do in any moment. And it's combined with a little bit of a sense of fear and anxiety. With a little bit of a sense of fear and anxiety. A little bit of a feeling of truly, deeply not knowing. So a very different understanding of what doubt might mean. And Broughton makes indecision and apprehension one word. So this is a profound feeling. All three are profound feelings. And Gaofeng and later other Linji and Rinzai teachers who followed him taught this. And it came down to us through Philip Kaplow and this more simplified translation into English. But so much more complex, so much more deeply rooted. So when we're talking about great doubt, when Hakuin is mentioning it, he's talking about this sense of indecision and apprehension, this deep not knowing, this trembling at the doorway of something so profound that we don't know yet in our own hearts. And yet, Hakuin promises us that we can know it. So this is what Hakuin says. When a person faces great doubt, before them there is in all directions only a vast and empty land without birth and without death, like a huge plain of ice extending in all directions. And maybe you've experienced this. I've certainly experienced this. A time in my life when all my strategies dropped away, and actually this happens over and over again because I keep picking my strategies back up and trying to use them, sort of like picking up, limp bread and trying to make it edible again. It's just hopeless, but you know, it's still bread, so I think maybe it'll be okay. But when I finally dropped all my strategies, when nothing else works, then I'm in this vast and empty land, a huge plain of ice extending in all directions, nowhere to go, nothing to do. Hakuin talks about this very movingly in his autobiographies, these moments when everything fell apart for him and his Zen practice seemed pointless. And he, as a human being, seemed like the worst human being on the planet. And then Hakuin goes on, penetrating it is trampling the multi-tiered gate of birth and death that has come down through endless kalpas. So this penetrating of that vast not knowing is complicated. It's a multi-tiered gate of birth and death. It's not just some simple thing, but it's everything we've ever thought about what it means to be human. We have to trample that gate because it's not useful to us anymore. It doesn't help when we're on that vast plain of ice to pull out our backpack and root around and see what we brought with us. All we can do is face into that vast nothing. And then he says it's penetrating the inner understanding and basic enlightenment of all the Tathagatas, that is, all the beings who came and went. Tathagata is a word that the Buddha used to refer to himself, and if you add an extra A in it, it means the one who has thus come, and if you take out that extra A, it means the one who has thus gone. So it's a perfect word for our coming and going, which, of course, Hakuin also refers to in the Song of Zazen. Coming and going, we are never astray. Being Tathagatas, we are never astray. This self is constantly moving. It's always in movement. It never settles into, oh yeah, that's just me. It's a great mystery. There's no way to know this ever-changing self. And even Dogen, who says to study the way is to study the self, follows that immediately by saying to study the self is to forget the self. It's the same impulse of understanding that we cannot fixate, and yet we do. And the basic enlightenment of all the Tathagatas, the inner understanding of all the Tathagatas, is in some way not belonging to any of us, and yet it is our birthright. We penetrate it. And we become everyone who's ever been on this path and realized this great way. Hakuin says, you must accept that the realization of so felicitous a thing as the great matter will involve a certain amount of suffering. And this is not conventional suffering. This isn't my legs hurt, my knees hurt, my ankles hurt, my back hurts, my shoulder hurts, I'm so tired, I'm so hungry, I'm so thirsty, I'm so cold, I'm so hot. It's not that kind of suffering. We get plenty of that at Sishin. But it's a deeper kind of suffering. It's the feeling of the hand clinging as hard as it can to all the old ideas of the self, all the old ideas of the way things are. At a certain point, we recognize how much it hurts to hold on to these things. Our endless strategies, self-definitions, plans, ways to hide from the simplicity of the world presenting itself to us. That little bird singing in the distance is not thinking about anything, I believe, except at the moment singing. How do birds stay alive in the winter? I'd be really worried about it. I don't know if the bird is worried. He's just singing. So this kind of suffering has to be faced into. We have to feel the tightness of our grip, and only then will it start to loosen, will it start to open, and the world will come forward to us. Hakuin says, realize that this cannot be handed down and cannot be explained, which is one of the reasons why it's so frustrating to be a Zen teacher. We try as hard as we can to hand it down. We try as hard as we can to explain it. But it can't be handed down or explained. I agree with Hakuin here. There's no way that it can be transmitted through anything we say, even what we do. But I know for myself that when I meet a person of the way, in the very first meeting, I recognize her. I recognize him as a fellow traveler. And my job as a teacher is to keep that in mind and heart until you realize it yourselves. And that's the work of a lifetime, so I don't always get satisfaction. But it's irrelevant. The great way will persist. The great way is so strong. This great heart that fills the universe and manifests in so many different ways. It's not really any of our business. None of us are in charge of the unfolding of this. And yet we say that the structures of the Zen path, we might say the technology of Zen, encourages a kind of way of not forgetting when the little moments pop up. There's a context for them. The context of sitting upright in the middle of everything without meddling. This is what we're learning here in our sitting. And Hockman says this famous line, which he didn't originate. We read it sometimes in koan commentaries and koans from a few centuries earlier. But he says it's like knowing for yourself by drinking it whether water is warm or cold. There's no argument here. Wu Men, the 13th century Chinese teacher who compiled the Gateless Barrier, said that it's like meeting your parents by the roadside. You just know it's them, even if they've been dead for a long, long time. Suddenly there's the face you've been longing to see, and there's instant recognition. It's like that, tasting water and knowing whether it's warm or cold. And then he says the 10 directions, that is, everything everywhere, melt before the eyes. And the 3 periods of time, this other delusion we carry with us about past, present, and future, they also just collapse, he says. They're penetrated in an instant. And then he expresses his great love of the way in the last 2 lines. He says, what joy is there in the realms of humans or gods that can compare with this? So this is the path that Hockman lays out for us. In the vast wilderness, in the desert, in the boundless stretches of ice extending in all directions, we're already standing in the water of awakening. We are already penetrated by it. And we must face into the immense suffering we bring on ourselves by clinging to some other idea about the way things are. And then, at some point, and it happens to everyone, big and small, in all kinds of shapes and forms, we will know this for ourselves. And the sound of the bird and the taste of the water, the feeling of the air on our skin, cannot be argued with. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue.
Thank you for that beautiful talk. What was coming up for me was, you know, it's the old saying, familiarity breeds contempt, right? No, really. And you know, all these things that we take for granted that we consider sort of mundane things, you know, brushing one's teeth or making breakfast, and, you know, we go through the motions and we do it, and we want these, you know, big experiences, and you know, we give these little sort of mundane things short shrift. And, you know, when we sit, you know, this sort of attitude kind of gets ground away, and the longer we sit and the years go on, and it grinds that attitude away. You know, I'm reminded of the koan, you know, the monk asks for the teaching, and the teacher says, well, did you eat your rice? Yeah. Wash your bowl then. You know, it's as simple as that. But we don't realize it, you know, and when we sit and we sit in stillness and we sit in silence and we begin to wake up, we begin to see it. And then there's that instant where, you know, we realize it. And everybody has to realize it for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I just love what you said, Stephen. It's so to the point, really, and extending the point a little bit more. And to also be cautious about how quickly the strategies will arise, even with that knowledge. You know, I'm going to really pay attention to brushing my teeth. Stephen said that's where it could happen. So I'm going to love. Can I taste the toothbrush for myself, whether it's mint or cinnamon? You know, you know what I mean? That everything could be co-opted by this. And we can't ignore the things that aren't splendiferous. You know, that's such an important... You can feel how... how delicate a matter it is, because the mind keeps interfering. But when you're really brushing your teeth, who knows? Anyway, thank you so much for that.
So, thank you for your talk, Melissa. And when you were talking about, you know, Hopland's autobiographical experiences, and I've read some of those too, they're quite striking. But something I had to do for my job is read a lot of Protestant spiritual autobiographies, including Puritan ones. And they have a very similar structure, you know, and there's this moment which is sometimes known as the dark night of the soul, mm-hmm. and the spiritual seeker is convinced of his or her own just complete, you know, reprobate status, and is convinced that they are the vilest of all sin. Not just a sinner, but at the very bottom, you know, way, way below anybody else, and that they've committed the sin that there's no redemption from, whatever that is. They're not sure what it is, but they're certain that they've committed it. And then that leads to a very different place. And so I was listening to that, and I was thinking, you know, how do we differentiate this Protestant heritage that you know some of us grew up with? I did. And where that leads is the sense of a personal savior, grace abounding to the cheapest of sinners, you know, not to I've always been a Buddhist. And I don't want to maybe you hear the resistance, I don't want to go to this place where we say, well, really, you know, it's all kind of saying the same thing, because I grew up in that tradition, and it was very important to me to reject it. There were a lot of things I found deeply wrong with it. You know, and that led me here. So I wonder if you could kind of speak to that. You know, that potential for confusion between Hakuin's spiritual autobiography and then those ones that are so notable in the Anglo-American tradition.
Where I go with this is that I have read writings from people in all different faith traditions about this, and for me, everyone who talks about this, some kind of we might call it mystical or some kind of awakening to something, they're elements that seem very familiar to me. And I think whatever tradition we come from, we're talking about something that has no words. So, you know, personal savior, or I've always been Buddha, none of that accurately describes anything. But there is this experience that I believe does not have a Zen trademark on it, but this experience of being human and waking up to brushing our teeth, waking up to this miraculous, wondrous, terrifying world we're in the middle of, that we are not running. So I think to say it's all the same misses the point. There certainly are, you know, each tradition has its own flavor, but for me, perhaps more useful to see how human beings, poets and painters and Protestants and Muslims have encountered some incomprehensible joy and wonder and different language, maybe some similar mystery of it all and some similar personal shift. So there is some way of meeting this mystery that can transform us. That anything we say about it is wrong. So that's where I go, more than saying, well, the Protestants are this and we're that. But there's some mystery that we're encountering here and finding some way to be in relationship to it.
So if I could just, I totally agree with what David just said, right, about, because this is my understanding as well, that there's this commonality of this experience, right? And this is something that James Ford said to me at one point. He said, so this is the experience that founds religions, right? And the problem from my idea of it is that there is this common experience of whatever you want to call it, oneness or emptiness and great joy and love and compassion and all these things arise in that moment perhaps. But then immediately the mind kicks in, right, and tries to explain, you know, so what is this experience and what does it mean? Right? And depending on you know, what religious and philosophical backgrounds we have, we make up these stories of, well, what could this experience possibly mean? It's so important to me, this thing that happened, that I need to know what this means, and so we go off and create this thing that may end up being a religion that we found. Right? And other people having similar experiences, then, you know, find themselves coming into agreement with this view of what this might mean. So I think you're right, right? That so just because people have this somewhat shared experience does not necessarily mean that the thing that they say about it is correct or useful or helpful or is going to, you know, not be the worst thing for me in particular, right? Because that can definitely, you know, exactly what you said about, you know, so the talking about the Christian understanding, for me, is not a helpful way to explain this experience. And yet, having read about, you know, like the Desert Fathers and the Cloud of Unknowing and their mystical experiences, I could identify very closely with these experiences that they had. And yet, they saw things very differently than we see in Zen. And I think there's a warning there, right? That we should not believe the stuff that Zen says just because we have these experiences, right? And this is related to what Melissa was saying about great doubt. The difference that I really appreciate about Zen is we don't actually ask people to believe in a particular canonical understanding of what this might mean. We say, okay, so you find your own meaning. Look to yourself, right? Taste the water. You have experienced this tasting the water. Was it hot or was it cold?
Thank you both.
I just would add to what Steve just said, that, you know, the minute that you move to any kind of description or explanation, you plug into a vocabulary. And words have connotations. And whether we like it or not, those connotations take over, at least to some degree. And the connotation, the structure of connotation that these different faith traditions have, do point us in different directions. And for some, this set of connotations works. For another, this other set of connotations works. But we can't avoid, I mean, this side, I've been struggling in this retreat, we can't avoid the words. So the words are going to be there both to help and to get in the way at the same time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, beautifully put.
Yeah. So well said. And the thing, one of the things I appreciate about the Zen teaching in particular is a real awareness of this exact thing you're saying. You know, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. You know, this sense that the teachings are the finger pointing at the moon and not the moon. And even that, as you say, doesn't save us from getting caught. It will take over again and again and again. And so our job is endlessly to let go of being Buddhist, or these, it's not the words, and you know that, and we come to know that. The words help us, and all of us here in this room have been so touched by these breadcrumbs dropped by teachers, but it's not the breadcrumbs, right? And we come to know this. So yeah, thank you so much for saying that.
Yeah, and you know, I keep thinking about an old Zen friend of mine whose husband was doing research on near-death experiences. And you know, these people would, their hearts would stop, or, you know, they'd die, and then they'd come back and be revived. And they had all these experiences that actually had some commonality to them. But what I found really interesting was that the Christians met Jesus. And the non-Christians did not meet Jesus. And the Buddhists met, you know, some fardo state. And it's like, wait a minute. So this part, I want to really emphasize how strong the words and the ideas are. That they're like iron, you know, it's like a suit of armor that we wear to protect ourselves. And even to, you know, maybe beyond our life, whatever you think about near-death experiences. He really believed that people had a commonality. He was looking for that. So he would not really pay attention to the research, at least in my memory, that didn't affirm that for him, right? So he also had an idea that people would go through a tunnel and meet their loved ones. But people actually had lots of different experiences, really different experiences. And I want to go back to just say in a slightly different way, because I don't think I've ever spoken about this before. I'm pretty sure I told you about it. But years ago, I had what I would call an awakening experience, but it was within a Christian tradition. I'd been reading a lot about St. Teresa of Lisieux, and I was just like really, really, I was having a dark night of the soul experience. And suddenly, I don't know what happened, but suddenly I was saved by her. And I remember going to my thesis advisor, because I was in graduate school, and telling her about it. He said, oh, you have a real taste for the mystical, don't you? And another friend of mine who was Jewish said, you're not going to convert to Christianity, are you? But there was this like, I was already a Zen practitioner at the time. I'd been practicing for about 4 or 5 years. And what I was able to do, because I was not brought up in any religious tradition, I was saved from that in a way, but then you have other stuff you're brought up in. I was able to see, oh, this is a way that something that happened to me that felt like a releasing, an affirmation, everything's going to be okay kind of experience could easily be, I could have just gone right down a road of, you know, going to a convent, right? It was just such a powerful thing. But Zen in that instance, I also went to my teacher about it, and he sort of poo-pooed it, but in that instance it saved me. Because for this very reason, that I was being trained to see through any ideas that I was clinging to. And this was an idea I was clinging to because it was a lot of fun. It was really fantastic. So everything has to be dressed up in something. And I think the idea is that we know that we're wearing clothing. You know, that's for me what's so important. And I like this dressing. I think this is very nice clothing, the Zen clothing. It's my preference. But I respect people who have other preferences, for sure.
And the other place I go is one teaching that the universe is a great bright mirror and generously will reflect whatever we present. So Jesus appears to to Jesus. Buddha appears to Buddha. Shit appears to shit. Some great flexibility, not caring. The universe doesn't care one whit what words we use, but will appear in you know, there some clothes. Wonderful that study, yeah.
And some of us, you know, I also want to make sure that we value the words, that the finger pointing to the moon is valuable. It's not just we have to get through it to get to the real stuff. Poets and dressmakers, you know, this is a real art. And just to know that it's that there's something else that's essential at the essence of things, that we can dress up any way we want, talk about any way we like, and we will never be able to comprehend it through words, through shapes and forms. And yet, it's present in all shapes and forms.
Yes, it's just with all of this said within your talk, what I find just so beautiful is that, you know, all of a sudden the bird came in, and there that was, you know, and you did point to it, of course, but it also, you know, it's just with words and without, but it's really moving, you know,
yeah.
And in your own practice, kind of that embodiment of you not plowing through with your words, but actually bringing that in. So that just spoke really strongly to me.
Great. So let's continue to listen to the Dharma talk.